everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. What this will mean for the future of women's reproductive rights and of the Supreme Court. I speak with Catherine Colbert, who argued the Supreme Court's last major abortion ruling. Plus,
Ron DeSantis and President Trump are sort of competing for the same voters. It's the same constituency.
Is Ron DeSantis the GOP's next Donald Trump? The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins joins me as the 2024 hype around Florida's governor grows. Then, decades of pain and hardship for Rohingya refugees. Hari Srinivasan speaks to Dr. Mohsina Chakladar, who has dedicated her life to helping them.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Bianca Golodriga in New York, sitting in for Christiane Amanpour, who will be back next week. Well, today, the Supreme Court overturns 50 years of abortion rights in America, with a majority opinion declaring we hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. Justice Samuel Alito writing for the majority states, Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. But never before has the court recognized a constitutional right and then taken it away. Liberal Justices Kagan, Breyer, and Sotomayor jointly wrote, "With sorrow for this court, but more for the many millions of American women who have today lost a fundamental constitutional protection, we dissent." President Joe Biden threw down a political gauntlet, reacting to today's ruling.
"Today, the Supreme Court of the United States expressly took away a constitutional right from the American people that it had already recognized. They didn't limit it. They simply took it away. That's never been done to a right so important to so many Americans. But they did it. It's a sad day for the court and for the country. But it doesn't mean the fight's over. Let me be very clear and unambiguous. The only way we can secure a woman's right to choose, and the balance that existed, is for Congress to restore the protections of Roe v. Wade as federal law."
In a CNN poll conducted after the leak of the Supreme Court's draft opinion, Americans said 66% to 34% that they did not want the Supreme Court to completely overturn its decision. Nonetheless, several states have trigger laws, with abortion bans ready to go into effect. It is a new, confusing, and potentially destabilizing world for women's reproductive rights and for America's courts. Reporter Ariane DeVogue joins me with the latest on today's decision. So, Ariane, let's just unpack what went down today. A constitutional right that was declared in 1973, affirmed in 1992 by Casey, has now been upended by five justices, three of whom said during their confirmation hearings that they respected precedent. Talk about the magnitude of today's ruling.
Right. As you say, today, the court wiping away near 50-year-old precedent, taking away a constitutional right that women had come to rely upon. And Justice Samuel Alito, hewing very closely to that leaked opinion that we saw last month, he said that Roe is egregiously wrong. He said that it is a right that's not found in the Constitution. And he said that it is a issue that belongs to the states, that this issue should go back to the states, the political process. And he made a point to say women have political power. Another thing he tried to do is wall it off from other opinions that share some of the same legal reasoning. Those opinions, for instance, having to do with gay marriage, right, and the right to contraception. He said that abortion is different because it has to do with taking potential life. It's a huge, huge victory for opponents of abortion who have worked on this literally for years, and of course, a devastating blow to supporters of abortion rights. And we saw that in this dissent. And what was unusual about the dissent is that it was written by all three of the liberal justices together, not just one author, as we usually see. As you said, they ended the opinion saying that they are doing so with sorrow for the millions of Americans who have lost a constitutional right. They say that this is a curtailment of women's rights and their status as equal citizens. And they also said how much this is going to impact poor women, because those women are the most who will feel the brunt of this, because they don't have the means to travel over state lines to try to find a state where they can get the procedure done. The liberals also lambasted Justice Alito for trying to wall off the opinion. They basically said the court has just gotten started, and they said that those opinions, including the gay marriage opinion, are now vulnerable. So really biting language there in the dissent.
Justice Thomas said that those cases should be reconsidered. So Alito may have walled it off and said that this is only applicable to abortion, but clearly other justices are suggesting that it has wider scope.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us, Ariane. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, today's ruling sets up potential court battles between states over conflicting abortion laws, and the language of the decision could put protections for same-sex marriage or even contraception at risk, as we just noted. In fact, you could hear the conflict over the case at the court today.
It is one important victory. It's not the end, but we are dancing on the grave of Roe versus Wade.
And I'm so glad that the justices actually established the justice and the rule of law in this land, and that so many millions of lives will be saved by this decision.
So what will all of this mean? Attorney Catherine Colbert argued America's last landmark abortion case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, before the Supreme Court in 1992. And she joins me now. Thank you so much for joining us. You have said that we as Americans and you as a lawyer expected today's ruling. Talk about why.
Well, unfortunately, there are five ultra-conservative justices on this court. Placed on the court through lots of machinations by the Republican Party, and they are intent on imposing their political, ideological views on the rest of Americans. This is really, I often say, winning in the Supreme Court is a lot like Sesame Street. You got to learn to count, and the only number that matters is five. And unfortunately, there are five justices who are intent on eliminating protections for women in a whole host of areas.
And as we noted, the impact will be immediate. Nearly half of all states have trigger laws that will eliminate abortion rights, whether it's today or in the weeks and months to come. Walk us through what this ruling just set into motion.
Well, essentially, state legislatures will have the last word on what is the law in their states. And that means that about 25 to 26 states that are controlled by anti-abortion Republican Party members, both in the legislature and in their gubernatorial seats, will pass laws that ban abortion. Now, some of those states have already done so. Others have done so, and they'll take effect within a couple of weeks or a couple of months. But the bottom line is within the next year, we're going to see abortion banned from as far as the east coast of Georgia, all the way west to Texas, north from the Canadian border, down through the mountain states to the Mexican border, with very few places for women to go to seek appropriate health care. And let's remember, that's what this is about. This is about health care for women facing pregnancies and the ability of them to choose how, when, with whom they have children. And both of those rights, the right to bodily autonomy, the right to decisional autonomy, are affected by this devastating ruling.
So half of all states are now on the verge of banning abortion, if not doing so immediately today. 16 states, including D.C., have increased abortion rights. Jeffrey Toobin has described this as sort of a legal civil war now that's just been unleashed between states. Do you agree with that? How is this going to work? And what are some of the consequences on the nation's most vulnerable women?
That's right. It won't affect all women the same. Even in the days before Roe, women with financial means were able to obtain abortions. But for women who have low incomes, who live in rural areas, who are disabled, or who are young, remember, this can affect teenagers, they will be less able to travel the 200, 300 miles they will need to do to seek a legal surgical abortion. Now, some of those women, unlike the days before Roe, will have access to medication abortion, but not legally. And so, again, they jeopardize their safety, their legal safety, by putting themselves up to potential prosecution for obtaining medication abortion, which is a safe and effective way to terminate an early pregnancy. But most important, and I think this is really key, those who are discriminated against in the healthcare system, primarily Black and Brown women, will suffer undue problems. And I think that, ironically, the very states that ban abortion also have the highest rates of maternal mortality. So what the state's saying to those women who are disproportionately Black and Brown is that you have to carry your pregnancy to term and your life will be in jeopardy because you are doing so.
There are three key pillars for those who oppose abortion, and that is protection of fetal rights, protection of women's health, and religion. You broke down, in your view and expertise, why they're not applicable. Talk about that.
Well, so if this were about a religion, you know, different religions around the world have different views on abortion, and the court ought to respect all religions. So, for example, you know, mainstream Protestant religions believe in the right to choose abortion. The Jewish religion, in many respects, requires abortion in some circumstances. So religion shouldn't be a pawn here because religions vary. And the court, in recognizing constitutional protection, said, we're going to let individuals rather than institutions make these decisions. Why? Because there's all different reasons that people choose to have abortion. And of course, it's not just about fetal rights, because if that were the case, our opponents would be protective of pregnant women, would be giving benefits for childcare and giving benefits for maternity leave and making sure that women can have safe pregnancies. None of that is the case. What this is really about, Bianna, is controlling women, making sure that women themselves, in consultation with their doctors, in consultation with their families, have no ability to make independent decisions. They prefer to have government do that. And to me, that is really problematic, because the guy in the state house who is looking for votes and looking for power really cannot understand the individual circumstances of American women and their families. And I think the hallmark of the Constitution is that it recognizes the protection of individual liberties, like the court has done for the last 50 years, and not make it depend, not make your ability to make these important decisions based on where you live or what race you are or who you love. It should be the individual decision. Why? Because we know best for what is right for us. And I think that's really the heart, at the heart of this.
So should Americans worry about other rights now being at risk in terms of privacy? We heard Justice Alito say that this is only applicable to abortion, but you heard Justice Thomas say that the other issues should be up for grabs at this point and should be reconsidered. We're talking about contraception. We're talking about same-sex marriage. We're talking about interracial marriage as well. How worried now should Americans be about those privacies?
I think we should be very worried, because this court is not basing its decisions on the rule of law and the principles of stare decisis that have governed this nation for decades. What this court is doing is imposing their ideological beliefs on the rest of us. And many of them dislike contraception as much as they dislike abortion, and frankly think certain forms of contraception are abortifacients. We're already seeing states try to restrict abortion. Besides abortion, restrict contraception. We're seeing states make attacks on trans families. We're seeing states make attacks on gay marriage. And all of those will go to this court. So it seems to me we are already at play in seeing restrictions and restrictions that are likely to be held by this ideological five-member majority. Let me just say one other thing. The rationale that the majority has used here is to say that you don't have a fundamental right to choose abortion because the word abortion is not in the Constitution.
Right.
And it is not part of a right that's been deeply rooted in our nation's history. Well, let's take those two points. First, you know, contraception's not in the Constitution. Gay marriage isn't in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The right to travel is not in the Constitution. There's all kinds of rights that the Supreme Court has recognized through the Due Process Clause that aren't specifically labeled in the Constitution. Why? Because our framers understood that it needed to use general language like liberty and equality and allow courts through the generations to interpret what those mean. For the court to say, well, it's not there, so therefore you have no right, is patently absurd. But the second piece, and I think it's lazy. I think it's absurd. I think it's just not true. And it masks what they're really trying to do, which is to prohibit abortion because they don't like it. And let me just say one other thing. This notion about being deeply rooted in our nation's history and traditions. Well, remember, women were not part of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. African Americans were not part of the Constitution. If you go back and only recognize rights that were respected when the Constitution was adopted, whole segments of our society would be wiped away, would be given no ability to function as equals in our nation. And I think that is a very, very disturbing argument, and one that, again, masks what the court is really trying to do here.
So in light of today's ruling and leading up to it, as you had anticipated, you say it's time to move on, perhaps move on even past Roe. But let me get you to respond to what we heard from the president today, saying that it's not in his power, it's in voters' power, it's in Congress's power to codify Roe v. Wade. We heard from Attorney General Garland today saying that the Justice Department will use every tool at our disposal to protect reproductive freedom after the high court ruling. What tools actually are there, aside from voters turning out and in making their voices heard?
Well, that's the most important. And again, remember that most of the onerous laws, or in fact, all of the onerous laws, are being passed in states that are controlled by the Republican Party, who is vehemently anti-abortion. So the key here is to get politically active. Our opponents have been politically active for 50 years. But we have relied on the integrity of the Supreme Court. And I think we have to quit hitting our heads against that marble staircase and begin to turn to political remedies. First, in states controlled by anti-abortion Republicans, and those even in purple states, we need to turn them blue, turn them supportive of abortion rights so that those onerous laws can be repealed. Second, we've got to change our Congress to make sure that the Congress has a majority that is supportive of abortion rights. And the only way we do that is to work really hard, not just voting every election. And remember, elections happen 2 times a year, not just once every 4 years, but also to work in campaigns of champions for choice. And that means donating to those campaigns. It means door knocking in those campaigns and writing postcards and sending letters and getting active, really, so that those individuals have a greater chance of winning. And lastly, let me just say this, is I think we need to make a lot more noise than we're making.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I was just going to ask you. This seems to have been a higher priority issue for Republican conservative voters than for Democrats, quite frankly, over the past several decades. Elizabeth Warren said that the reason for that is perhaps they thought that Roe was safe in law and that it was protected, and thus voters weren't so fearful that it could be taken away from them. But here we are today.
Yeah, you know, I think that was legitimate because, of course, it has never happened in history that a constitutional right deemed fundamental, relied upon by millions of American women, has been, you know, jerked away, just taken away. That's never happened. So it was reasonable for those on our side of the issue to depend on the courts, but we can't do so any longer. And I think we need to make noise because those who oppose abortion get off easy, because we aren't demanding that they really look at the effect of their votes on women. And let me give you an example. In Texas, when they banned abortion, the legislature did that action in, you know, 2 or 3 months before it became national news. We can't let that happen any longer. We've got to be out there calling for our rights, working in elections, And lastly, and Bianna, I think it's really important, we need to help the women who are so devastated by this ruling.
Catherine Colbert, thank you so much for your time in helping break this down for us on this significant day, landmark day. Thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, today's Supreme Court ruling is one of the legacies of former President Trump. Another is the January 6th hearings. On Thursday, they delved into how President Trump tried to use the Justice Department to overturn the 2020 election. Now, throughout the hearings, conservative Republicans have stood up to President Trump. And while many have believed him to hold an iron grip on the GOP, it seems that too could be waning. There's a lot of buzz around Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis right now as Trump's heir in waiting. The New Yorker's Dexter Filkins digs into DeSantis and the man and politician in his latest piece and asks, can Florida's leader supplant Trump as the dominant force of the Republican Party? Here's our conversation. Dexter, thank you so much for joining us. The name of the piece is Can DeSantis Displace Donald Trump as the GOP's Combatant in Chief? Did you get an answer to that question in your research?
Yeah, I think the answer is he'd certainly like to, and he wants to. I think Ron DeSantis wants to be president, and sooner rather than later, and would like to run in 2024. So the question really at this point is, I think the big question is to answer that is what is Donald Trump going to do?
You describe him as articulate, fast on his feet, and others have called him Trump with a brain. Is that a winning combo for 2024 for the Republican Party?
You know, it worked for Trump in 2016. I think those circumstances were pretty exceptional, you know, given his opponent at the time, Hillary Clinton, and among other things. So I don't know the answer to that. I think what is clear is that Ron DeSantis and President Trump are sort of competing for the same voters. It's the same constituency. And so that's why when you hear DeSantis, I mean, he speaks in complete sentences and he's very articulate, but it's essentially he's targeting the same group of people, and which is basically the white working class, and largely, and with, you know, kind of smatterings of other groups. But and the way he does that is he just like Trump, he riles him up, he gets him really angry and gets him fired up against the elites. It's a similar playbook. And so is that coalition big enough? Can it like put him over? I don't know. I really don't know. But he hasn't shown any signs yet, DeSantis, of kind of reaching out to anyone else.
Yeah, it's interesting because Trump takes credit for him and views DeSantis as his own creation after supporting him, his nomination for governor back in 2018. And DeSantis early on then began mimicking Trump and his gestures, even in a campaign ad that went viral where his kids were, you know, building the wall and really embracing Trump. How do the two feel about each other today?
Really good question. I think it was described to me by somebody who knows both of them very well as a complicated relationship. I think, you know, they're on the surface, they both make nice. I spoke to President Trump last week and he said, we have a great relationship. He must have said that 15 times, which, you know, led me to believe that it was something less than great. But I think the relationship is complicated for the reasons that we're discussing, which is Ron DeSantis is very, very ambitious. He practically radiates ambition. He wants to be president. And I think my sense is that the president, former President Trump, feels like Governor DeSantis was not or has not been sort of sufficiently grateful for what he did. And it was really Trump's endorsement that kind of did it for DeSantis. And somebody said to me, he won't kiss the ring. And that's what angers Trump. And so I think the relationship is actually way more complicated than either one of them has let on.
You really delve into who the man Ron DeSantis is and his background, his education, his focus, his attention to detail, his brilliance, as those who even his, you know, his arch enemies would describe him as. And you begin the piece by talking about COVID and his response to COVID. He is a libertarian, one could describe his politics, but he really took a turn From his approach early on into the dealing with the pandemic, where he supported lockdowns and followed the government guidelines and listened to Anthony Fauci for a few weeks, and then things began to change. Why is it you think he lost faith in the scientific establishment?
Really good question as well. I mean, I think the question about Governor DeSantis has always been, you know, how much of it is conviction and how much of it is opportunism? And I think here's a kind of the COVID response is a perfect example. He started out kind of on the same playbook as everyone else, and then he kind of threw the playbook out. And what he says, and I think there's a lot to this. His aides tell me he read the data. He pored over the data, and I you know, there's a in the piece itself, there's an interview with one of the scientists that he relied on who said it's extraordinary. Like, Governor DeSantis clearly had read all the literature. You know, not just the abstracts. He'd read all the articles. He was totally fluent in it. And so what Governor DeSantis decided was, you know, basically, I know as well as the experts, and I'm gonna chart a different course. And that course is, we're throwing everything open, and we're gonna, because basically the virus is unstoppable. And so the one thing that we can do is protect the elderly and close the nursing homes, which they did, and try to ride it out. And that's what they did. And I think it's too early, you know, given all the data that we have, it's too early to say how well that worked.
Let's talk about his strengths and weaknesses. You describe a strength. Somebody you spoke with said that Ron's strength as a politician is that he doesn't give an F. Ron's weakness as a politician is that he doesn't give an F. Longer term, on that right. path towards the Oval Office, which of those is more beneficial for him? The fact that he doesn't give an F, or does it hurt him more that he doesn't give an F?
I don't know. I mean, that's like one of the biggest questions, because I think he's a conviction politician. I think he knows what he knows. He knows what he believes, and he's going to stick to that. But he's basically just disregarded 50% of the voters. He's like, forget it. I'm going that way. Rather than trying to sort of bring everybody along. And that's really appealing to his supporters. It's like, you know, Ron's great. He's awesome. You know, he tells everybody to, like, jump in the lake. But I don't know if that works if you're president of the United States. You know, we got a big country, and it's very diverse. And I don't know if it's good. I don't know if it would work for him either to get elected or to be president if he's basically happy to, like, blow off half the country.
You bring up his appeal in front of a large audience, and that has to count for something, at least. And that's where the American public, aside from just his constituents in Florida, have really gotten to know who he was. We'll talk about Fox News and his relationship with Fox in just a moment. But let's play a clip of him speaking at CPAC in Florida earlier this year, because not only does he have an ability to speak to a large public and open up that charisma that perhaps isn't there on a one-on-one level, but he's able to hone in on really firebrand issues and tackling what he views as the left wokeism in the country. Let's listen.
The woke is the new religion of the left. And this is what they have in mind. That's why they want CRT, because they want to divide the country. That's why they remove statues of Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln and Teddy Roosevelt. Take George Washington's name off schools, because they want to erase that history. They want to delegitimize our founding institutions, and they want to replace that with their left-wing ideology as the foundational principles of our modern-day society. Wokeism is a form of cultural Marxism.
CRT, of course, referencing critical race theory there. Listen, this is something that he doubled down on, not only on CRT, but the Don't Say Gay bill in Florida. Is that a winning strategy nationwide, given that that is the direction that many in his party have taken?
I don't know. Like, you can see from the speech, it's really effective. You know, it's really effective. He sets it up, and then he, like, knocks it down. And one of his advisors said that to me. He said, you know, Ron needs a foil. And the foil is the press, and it's the kind of, you know, the left wing of the Democratic Party, the kind of the woke piece of that party. I don't know. Like, I think I was there for that speech, and I saw it. Again, it was really effective as kind of as far as it went, which is, I'm against this. I'm against, you know, I'm against CRT. I'm against, you know, it was basically a long list of things that he opposed. And so I was sort of sitting there like thinking, I mean, I grew up in Florida where where he's the governor. And I thought, well, what are you for? You know, and like he didn't talk about that. So he was just firing the crowd up and saying, like, I'm going to oppose these lefties and I'm going to crush the woke people. And they were loving it and they were eating it up. But it was like, but what are you going to do? You know, like once you've done that, like, what are you going to do? And he didn't have anything. He didn't speak to that.
But you could argue that speaks to many aspiring presidents or people who aren't in office. It's much easier to knock what is already out there as opposed to coming up with new legislative ideas, right? What role did Fox News and has Fox News played in enabling that foil that you just described?
It was pretty amazing. I mean, I did a public records request for like a really brief period, like basically right after Trump left office, and Biden came in. The thought being, you know, Trump's not around anymore. What's Fox going to do? So I just looked at this 4-month period in 2017, and it was remarkable. It was Fox basically, and I'm surmising here, but Fox basically reached out to DeSantis almost every single day, and said, "Will you please be on air? Will you please be on Tucker Carlson's show? Will you be on our morning show? Will you be on Laura Ingraham?" Every single day. I mean, and they kind of, you could see it was a kind of collaborative enterprise. Fox wanted to kind of push him forward, and kind of they said in the emails, "We see you as a national leader." So they were kind of, I mean, whatever else it is, it's like it's not journalism, but they kind of put him forward. And of course, DeSantis was like the people around him was, they were just eating it up, and they were like, "Great, you know, we'll be on it Tuesday at 8 o'clock." And so it was this kind of synergistic relationship that really pushed DeSantis forward and into kind of onto the national stage. And that was, you know, at the time it was before the COVID response. But that's kind of what continued, which was as DeSantis became this kind of, you know, outlier in the COVID response, Fox basically made him a conservative folk hero. And that's kind of what he's become. He's a folk hero. He's the guy that like sticks it to the elites, and he's our guy. And that, instead of just being a Florida phenomenon, that's now like a nationwide phenomenon.
Yeah, never mind that he's a Yale and Harvard grad and sort of sticking it to the elite. But he is able to sort of encompass that everyday guy quite well, and that is the role that Fox News has created for him or helped create for him. Let me finally ask you about bigger picture. The country, the party going forward, we are now through 5 public hearings of the January 6th committee. They've shown how Trump's lies about the election not only caused harm to those at the Capitol and threatened our democracy, but also to everyday Americans who were just doing their jobs and doing what they were supposed to do, and the threats against their lives, all in pursuit of Trump's conviction that he will have a second term in office. DeSantis, in a way, played a role in that, fed into that as well. He refused to say that President Biden has been legitimately elected. He enacted restrictions on voting right by mail and at drop boxes, even though there was no evidence suggesting that right. There were irregularities. What does that say about what kind of president a President DeSantis could be? Because there are some that say, listen, President Trump and his cronies there were Keystone Cops. Thank goodness they didn't know the constitutional law, or he at least didn't know much about it. Ron DeSantis does. You can't say the same right about him. Would he uphold the Constitution, in your opinion, as president?
It's a really good question. Super good question. I think, because everything you pointed out is true. He's refused to say that Biden is legitimately elected. He refers all the time to the Biden regime, you know, like it's the regime in Tehran. And he's been very, very careful about that. I mean, I think at one point he condemned the January 6th, insurrection. But Ron DeSantis, you know, Harvard Law School, Yale grad. He wrote a book about the Constitution and the Founding Fathers. He understands, and I think he respects the constitutional order And I think he knows American history. He taught American history. So I think in him is a kind of imbued respect, a pretty deep respect for the American system. I think the question, though, is, you know, he's so ambitious that those two things are in conflict. And so far, he hasn't had to rein in his ambitions, and he's just gone, you know, 100 miles an hour. And so the big question is, what's going to happen if that comes to a head? If Ron DeSantis, running for president as president, is confronted with a close call, or not even a close call, on the Constitution, what's he going to do? And I want to think that respect for American history and the constitutional order that I think he has, I want to hope that would prevail, but it's unclear.
Yeah, and that determination, that ambition, you end the piece by saying Ron has heard way too many times that you're next. Mind you, he's only 43 years old. Dexter Filkins, thank you so much. A really fascinating piece. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're going to turn now to news out of Myanmar, where deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from house arrest to solitary confinement in prison. She's been held by the military since being ousted in a coup in February of last year. The Nobel laureate fell from grace after her refusal to protect the Rohingya minority. Hundreds of thousands of them fled to Bangladesh after a brutal military campaign of killing 5 years ago. Dr. Mohsina Chaklander has been visiting the now infamous refugee camp Cox's Bazar since those killings. She's the medical chair of Humanitarian Auxilium, and she joins Hari Srinivasan to discuss the conditions refugees are facing there.
Only time will tell. Well, we turn now to more news from Myanmar, where deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi has been moved from house arrest to solitary confinement in prison. She's been held by the military since being ousted in a coup in February of last year. Of course, Suu Kyi has been condemned for her refusal to protect the Rohingya minority. Hundreds of thousands of them fled to Bangladesh after a brutal military campaign of killing 5 years ago. Dr. Mohsina Chaklander has been visiting the now infamous refugee camp, Cox's Bazar, since those killings. She's the medical chair of Humanity Auxilium, and she joins Hari Srinivasan to discuss the conditions that refugees are facing there.
Biana, thanks, Dr. Mohsina Chaklander. Thanks so much for joining us. What made you want to go to Bangladesh? What made you want to get involved in this?
So back in 2017, when the genocide started, the images of helpless children, women crossing the border, and in dire situations, I just couldn't sleep for many nights. It was very difficult to see that as a mother and as a physician. So I thought, in Canada, we're privileged, and as a physician, it's my duty to help these people. And hence, I just looked into avenues how I can go and volunteer and treat these patients. So one day I had a discussion with my husband. I kissed him goodbye along with my 2-year-old and 4-year-old. And I was off to Bangladesh for a couple of weeks to see for myself and treat these patients.
No, I think oftentimes, at least given these media cycles, we sort of go from crisis to crisis. And a lot of people might not recognize or realize that there is still a crisis along the border there between Myanmar and Bangladesh. And you've been there multiple times. What were the kinds of medical ailments and problems in 2017? And what did you see on your most recent trip?
So the genocide started August of 2017, and I was there around December. And at that time, people were still coming. By that time, we had about 600,000 people come into Bangladesh. So with the type of problems I was seeing back then was malnutrition in kids, kwashiorkor, tuberculosis, and a lot of infection and even Graves' disease, which we don't see here as much because of our medication and treatment. And there was a lot of trauma for the first time I went to see them, especially mental trauma. Like I had a 30-year-old woman come in to see me. She was complaining of abdominal pain. And after an exam, I figured out it wasn't the root cause of her visit. And I started to question her. She fled from Myanmar with her family and six kids. And she was a farmer back in Myanmar. She was quite happy with her small farm and animals. And one day, all of a sudden, the Burmese military were there and they were burning her crops and the vegetation. So she and her husband just froze in panic. And then they started to just grab their kids from wherever the kids were. But unfortunately, everything happened so quickly. They witnessed their one-year-old and three-year-old sort of burn in their homes while they were trying to gather the other children and flee from there. So they were not able to, you know, rescue their one-year-old and three-year-old, and they just heard their cries. And then she traveled on foot for 14 days with her family without any food, and they just had a bit of drink from the stream water. And, you know, we felt that it was so important not to just treat their physical wounds, but also to treat their mental wounds. So it's not easy to forget these stories. So when you come back, you want to advocate for them. You want to keep their stories alive because they made you see through their stories a glimpse of the horror they had lived.
So in 2017, when you were seeing perhaps a lot of physical injuries from the trek and the flight from Myanmar, now, when on your most recent trip, the camps are still there, they're more established. What are the kinds of things that people are coming to your clinics for?
Yeah, so Humanity Auxilium has established two clinics. It has started in January to be a formalized clinic. Before that, we were working with the local NGOs. So now we're seeing these patients have chronic illnesses, diabetes, heart disease, cholesterol, blood pressure, and also a lot of infection still because of the conditions of the camps, lots of skin disease, a lot of dental disease. Some of the kids have never, ever seen a dentist in their life. So we see all that. And on top of that, the mental anguish, the mental diseases are also there, especially PTSD and depression. For the young women and girls, it's especially difficult because they not only have to deal with their mental trauma, but they also have to look after their many young children, because in Myanmar, they always had a tendency to be pregnant, because if you're pregnant, you're less likely to be raped and less likely to be attacked. So they don't have much knowledge of birth control or anything like that. So a lot of education has to be done as well. And most of my work was also gaining the trust of these people, that they can trust us with their health, because they did not trust the health officials back in Myanmar. So any health-related problems, they would go to their elders in the community or the midwives. So it's a lot of education that we do, and also training for the local doctors, because whenever we go there, we're either teaching complicated pregnancy-related cases or infection-related cases, so that they can continue our work when we're physically not there.
How did COVID impact these refugee camps where there's tremendous population density already?
There are about 34 camps, and it's in a very small space of 13 kilometers square only. And in 1 kilometer square, as of 2020, there are about 46,000 people all squished in. So COVID set off a ripple of panic all over the camp, as well as, you know, in the local doctors as to how they were going to manage. We did the outreach program in COVID because in the camps, people were quite afraid of COVID. They did not want to come forth with symptoms because the government had made isolation centers. So if anybody came forth with symptoms, they would be sent to the isolation centers. And that's a total nightmare for the Rohingyas, where, you know, they would be separated from their family like they would in Myanmar. So what we did was we established 4 outreach programs where there would be a physician, a Rohingya volunteer to speak the language, our volunteer, midwife and nurse, who will actually go into the shelters of 2 camps, 17 and 20. And they will ask and assess them for symptoms according to the WHO survey. And because there was no testing back in 2020 when the COVID broke out, If they answered few positive tests, that was considered a positive case. And we did education, and we also treated symptomatically with antibiotics and antipyretics. And then we went back for follow-up. So our organization, our tiny organization, did assess more than 80,000 people. And we did more than 6,000 education sessions because we were able to break myths about COVID and also debunk some of the gossip that was going on that, you know, if you drink this water, you can get rid of COVID, things like that. So I think people underestimate small organizations, but if your passion, dedication is there, you know, it's possible to move mountains.
Give me an idea of what happens in basically a society where these refugee camps are, where there are hundreds of thousands of people. Most of them are unemployed. Many men in those villages can't find jobs, and they're not welcome in the surrounding community. So what are the ripple effects to the women and children in these camps?
So the women and children, they suffer the most. They were abused back in Myanmar, and here they have sometimes abuse from their husbands because the husbands are frustrated. They at least were farmers or had small jobs back in Myanmar. Now they have absolutely nothing to do. Sometimes the local community might employ them to build up a structure or build to fix some toilets in the camps, but these are not permanent jobs that they have. And a lot of the women are widows now. So they've lost their husbands, and these men tend to marry now 2-3 times. And so the first wife with their kids are sort of semi-abandoned. So there is a lot of mental anguish going there. This time around, I was there and we have established a mental health facility for the psychosocial support of these young women and girls. And I interviewed a 13-year-old who was married off to her cousin, who was already married with kids without her will, because the father wanted to make sure before he had many children. So he wanted to sort of give up the responsibility of this young girl, because if she's married off, it's one less mouth to feed for him. And she gets beaten on a daily basis by her in-laws, by her husband, and her husband's first wife. So she's basically used as a slave, sexually abused as well as physically. So she tried to run off from her in-laws' place twice to her father's place, which is in a different camp. There are 34 camps in total, and the camps are quite far apart. So she ran off twice, but she was always sent back to her husband by her dad, because, he will not, have her back in. Then there'll be another mouth to feed because they themselves are in dire condition. So what do you say to this 13-year-old? I can't even say, you should just continue your education. Don't go back to your husband, because after third to fifth grade, there is no education for women. Usually the parents don't want to send their girls to school anymore because they're sort of priming them for marriage. And they think if they get into trouble, they might get a bad name and they will not get married in a good family. But at least with our organization, we have established a safe place for women, where women are being taught how to knit and make bedspreads as well as shawls. And they get a percentage of their income. So at least they have some skill set that they will be acquiring, and they will have a little bit of income as well to stand on their feet.
How do you gain the trust of women and girls in situations like this? I mean, even though you speak the language, you're from the outside. You're going to be able to get on a plane and leave.
Yes. So that's very important. So in any community, it's important to get the local physicians and the local NGOs to be your ally. And we have been quite fortunate that we have two local NGOs who have been working side by side. And even if we are in Canada and other part of the world by WhatsApp, by telephone communication, by email, we're always in touch with them. So we have hired Rohingya volunteers, and we give them a salary as well to help us translate. So when you see that, you know, a person of your community is working with them and they're telling you that, you know, they're doing good work, that also automatically helps to gain their trust. And in the camps, there are some Rohingya individuals, usually men, who are in charge of like 10, 15 shelters. They're called Majis. So we have been working with them as well to help us, you know, convey the message that we're there to help them and this is what we're doing. And that has helped a lot to gain some of the trust that they have lost from decades of abuse.
So what do you see happening to all of these children that you might see on your repeat visits? I mean, from 2017 till now, are we talking about a lost generation here that aren't going to school, that don't have any kind of stability or security in their lives?
Yeah, so I did visit a couple of community schools, and their education is very, very rudimentary. They're taught Burmese, English, and a little bit of math, but not Bengali, because the Bangladesh government doesn't really want them to integrate, because once they learn the language, they might get a job and they might integrate. So they don't want that. The kids are still hopeful. They hear stories from their parents, how their land was and, you know, where they lived, and they're kind of hopeful. And some of them think that this is how life is. I met a very bright 18-year-old, the second time I went, and he tells me that when he was in Myanmar, he would have to go on a boat for an hour to get to his school. And that also, if it flooded, was very difficult for him to do that. He would come back, and when he would study, the military will come around. So if it is after 5 p.m. and it's dark, you cannot have any of the lights on. So his parents will really shut the shutter of their homes, and he will light a small candle and study under that candlelight, because he was a very bright student and he wanted to be a teacher. So now in Bangladesh, he's losing hope. Like, how do I get further education? At least I was getting some education in Myanmar. So we're trying to support him from Humanity Auxilium. We bought him a laptop to see if he can take some online courses from outside. But that's also very difficult, because the internet situation in the camps is quite difficult. So to answer your question, it's a dire situation. We don't know what will happen to these kids. They will have likely very minimal education and maybe some minimal skills that they might acquire, but you know, it's hard to know what will happen.
Sometimes I wonder if you think that the world has sort of forgotten this. I mean, it's been 5 years since the genocide images came on TV. It's really been longer. I mean, at least 10 years since the tensions between these communities was flaring up. But we have so many different crises today that we're watching on the news, that this is just one that kind of flies under the radar.
I think the Ukraine war, and then other crises all over the world, such as the Yemen or the Syrian crisis as well. So it seems definitely like, you know, people have forgotten about it. But I think it's important to keep their cause alive and to advocate for them, because, like I said, for generations and generations, they have been oppressed. They don't have a very good advocacy group for them, although some people are doing quite a bit these days. So it's important to keep their cause alive, because these are hundreds and thousands of people stuck in limbo without any fault of their own. And they, because of their religious belief or the way they look and being a minority, they've been tortured and they've lost everything they owned. So it's very important to keep their cause alive and to keep reminding the world that if one community suffers, then we all suffer.
Dr. Marcina Chakradar from Humanity Auxilium, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A very important plea not to forget the Rohingya. And finally, back to the future. As we enter the post-Roe era, beginning today for millions of women in America, nearly 50 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that a woman's right to make her own decisions about her pregnancy deserved the highest level of constitutional protection. Abortion services became safer and more accessible throughout America, and women invested in their education and careers in ways that weren't possible before. But the tide has changed. Half a century of progress erased today with a monumental Supreme Court decision. And with that, we leave you with the words of political activist and feminist organizer Gloria Steinem, who took to Twitter after the ruling today to say, "Banning abortions does not stop the need for them. It just bans their safety." Well, that is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you so much for watching, and goodbye from New York.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, host of the Chasing Life podcast. In honor of our 10th season, we want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 470-396-0832 and tell us how you chase life. It could be used on an upcoming episode.